Okay, so great to be here with you once again. And for those of you who don't know me, my name's Peter Elliott. I've got a background in church history. So when I get invited here, it's to do probably a little bit less of a sermon than a lecton, I've decided. More of a cross between, some sort of hybrid between a lecture and a sermon, and probably leaning a little bit more towards the lecture side of things. So they keep inviting you back, so that must sort of be reasonably acceptable. But if you're not used to that, then, well, that's what you're in for this morning. Okay? So that might be a good reason to actually pray. So let's do that. Lord, thank you for this morning. Thank you for this faithful group of people gathered here. Thank you for the exploration we're about to move on to this morning. I pray that you use the material that we're sharing to shine a light on our own hearts and our own self-understanding so that we may be better equipped to serve you and serve the people around us. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so the first thing, I didn't realise, did anyone else realise that most of you probably have seen a painting that looks something like this, but I didn't realise that, anyone looking at this and thinking the colour's a bit different? Because there's actually numerous ones of the Scream, apparently, and this latest one, which looks a bit bluer than the ones I've seen before, is apparently just, this has got nothing to do with the topic, by the way, has apparently just been sold. It's the only version of the Scream that is not currently in a museum, so it's up for private grabbing. I think it went for something like 139 million whatevers. It went for a lot of money. That wasn't my interest in it. It's just I just looked at it, grabbed a picture online and thought, this is a different colour, and then kept reading and found out there's more than one of them. So there you go. And you'll also notice that the topic that is on the screen is slightly different than the topic that's been advertised. So you've got modernism, and I tend to probably use the word modernism more often than modernity. But I've realised that there is the possibility for a little bit of confusion here. Okay, so if I'll probably use the terms interchangeably, but if you're somebody who's an art critic or something, I realise if I didn't make this disclaimer at the start, you're going to pounce on me, okay, and say you're incredibly confusing, and which wouldn't necessarily surprise me in the least. But anyway, so if we're looking at the death throes of really modernity, we should really try to at least be clear. What do I do then? Who the murder victim is, if you like. So really, modernism is a cultural term that relates particularly to the late 19th, early 20th century, and has a big focus on art and literature. We'll talk a little bit more about Romanticism as we go through, and. But that's not what we're really talking about today, okay? So we're talking about something different, a much longer and broader term that really relates more to what we might think of as the modern era, okay? So if you wanted a detailed examination of, you know, artistic and cultural depths around the term modernism, A, I'm not your person, and B, this is not your day, okay? All right, so we're moving into a slightly different direction. All right, what is this modernity thing? This really is so much. If you haven't ever looked at this area, it sheds such a light on who we are and the complexity around the people in society at the moment that we're trying to minister to. Really, there's a very long gestation period here. It's a case of how long is a piece of string, really? Where do you start? I'm choosing to kick off around about there. You could go back to someone like Charlemagne if you wanted to, in the middle of the what we think of as the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, where there was a bit of a mini Renaissance. But certainly if you look at the rise of the universities, which kick off around about 1100, that's a key factor in where we're going. There was a bit of a perpetual motion machine happening between these two. You know, you put a university into a town, naturally enough, because you want to have people to go to it. But once you put a university into a town, the town gets bigger because people are attracted to the university. And then subsidiary industries arise that feed into university. And then you've got a rising literacy level. Now, this has to be said, this is highly relative, this term rising literacy level back then, because as late as the early 13th century, there was still a major literacy problem amongst the clergy, let alone anybody else. But still, it was rising. Then something we've all heard of, really, the Renaissance, you know, lots of statues and artworks and popes that seem to have endless pockets of money to sponsor aforesaid artworks and statues. And a change coming in really the way we viewed ourselves, fueled by the printing press a little bit later on, and then these guys. You know, one of the fascinating things here is the church is a major player historically with the Reformation in the birth of modernity. But as modernity chugs along in the succeeding centuries, it becomes a major factor on the church. So, you know, we've contributed, but we have helped form, but we are also being formed by what we're looking at today. The humanists, and again, a massive term understood in different ways, but what we're meaning back then is people who were particularly concerned with going back to original sources. So rather than assuming what currently existed was necessarily the be-all and end-all, which, you know, certainly happens today with most of them have left, that's good. Young people in music, you know. I mean, you talk to a young person, have they ever heard of Elvis Costello? No. You know, I mean, this is you know, a matter of great grief to me. And so it's what's happening now is it. What happened 10 or 20 years ago might as well never have happened, that sort of thing. The humanists said, well, hang on a minute. Why don't we actually go, if we want to understand, for example, what the apostles understood by the gospel, maybe we should actually not just use the Latin Vulgate. Maybe we should try to get behind that a little bit. Maybe we should try to get back to the original text, that sort of stuff, which then fuels the Reformation and then a challenging of authority, the authority of the church. Then we have further challenging of authority. It wasn't... Once you started challenging one authority, everything started to crumble. The nexus between church and state was so strong, had been in place for so long, that it was impossible to start questioning one authority, i.e. the authority of the church to proclaim on matters of doctrine and to interpret scripture. Once that had happened with the Reformation, then it was just a matter of time before people started also questioning the authority of the state. And so you've got things happening like the English Civil Wars in the middle of the 17th century, chaps like, you know, Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans and, you know, Charles I getting beheaded. The concept happening then that a monarch could actually commit treason was the concept that was earth-shattering. Because mostly, what's the definition of treason? It's something against the monarch. The idea that the monarch could commit treason, which certainly surfaced around Charles I, and we're not going into detail here, but further reading in your own time, perhaps, if you're not aware of the general stuff happening there, started the idea that monarchs were actually responsible to people. They weren't, and that led to the idea we have today of a constitutional monarchy, where monarchs are not above the law, monarchs are in fact answerable and accountable. That was a new idea, okay? Over in Europe, they had something called the 30-Year War that dominated the first half of the 17th century. And that was a lot about religion, trying to figure out how do we have this church-state relationship where the ruler of the state is also supposed to be the ruler in religious issues when we're actually starting to get a diversity of religious issues happening. So at that point, we are on the brink of something quite new. And this is really our birthplace of modernity, if you like. All of those points on the previous slide really take us to a point where we're saying goodbye, in a sense, to the Middle Ages, with the Reformation era forming a bit of a bridge between the two, and saying hello to the modern age. It's always a shock to students. You know, I love saying when I'm teaching church history classes, when do you think the modern era began? And they take one look at me, decide to be extremely diplomatic, and say, 1950? You know, really thinking it's something like 2000. Okay. And they've gone way out on a limb saying 1950, you know. Because, of course, it's got to have something to do with proximity to when they were born, right? It's quite a shock to a lot of young people to find out that they actually might have ways of thinking that are incredibly close to people who might have lived in the late 17th or 18th centuries. Okay? Very profound shock in most cases. So that 30 years war we mentioned over in Europe comes to an end with something called a Treaty of Westphalia, which really means, okay, we've been killing each other over issues of religion for 30 years. We're just exhausted. You know, we really hate what you believe, Protestants, if you're a Catholic, or we really hate what you believe, Catholics, if we're Protestants, but we can't get rid of you. So we're going to stop trying, even though we'd really like to. You know, so we somehow have to live with you, distasteful though it may be. Okay, so this was the beginning of our modern idea of toleration, in the sense that you're living in reasonable proximity to people who believe something that's markedly different from what you believe, but you're actually not going to kill them because of it. So you're not that threatened by it, presumably, which is that's sort of a modern idea. Now, I know there are people who don't necessarily still subscribe to that, and we'll talk about that a bit later, but that's a very modern thing, this idea of toleration of different viewpoints, of plurality of religious belief. This is where it started. Okay, this is one of the reasons we talk about the middle of the 17th century really probably being the time that modernity, the modern age, came to us. Okay, so what does it start to look like? Well, for the first time in a very long time, I was talking about that toleration thing in the mid-17th century, by the way, in a history class, and a student said to me, well, hang on, what about the Roman Empire? Weren't they tolerant of religions? You know, they'd move into an area and they'd have this concept of religio licita, where you could have, you know, legal religions. They had a place of respect for religions that already existed. And I said, well, do you remember that thing about persecuting Christians that went on for quite a while? They said, oh yeah, I completely forgot about that. You know, so it was toleration within limits, really. Not really the modern sense of the term. Okay, so we start to get that. Church-state link had been in place really, if you like, since the time of Constantine, well over 1,000 years. Any time you start saying, excuse me, this idea that's been in place, you know that one that's been in place for 1,000 years? I'd like to get rid of it. You're not going to have a lot of friends, okay? Just ask the Anabaptists, for example. Okay, so that was dissolving monarchs answerable to the people. And now that we've got onto a bit of a roll with questioning established authority, the authority of the church, the authority of the state, we've raised the question, what's the new authority? What is it? Well, it's not the church, it's not the king, it's not really going to be scripture because we're starting to get busy questioning that. And so we hit something called the Enlightenment, coming straight on the heels of this, which usually is seen as beginning around 1700. And as most of you would know, this is the big movement about reason. It's all about reason. Reason is king. Reason is the key to continual progress. Reason is the measure of all things, including religious issues. So when we look at something about Christianity, is it reasonable? Is what we ask. If it's not reasonable, we chop off the bits that aren't reasonable. But what's the measure of reason? Who decides what's reasonable? And increasingly, it's us. It's the individual who becomes the arbiter. So in a de facto sense, when we say what is the new authority as we enter this modern age, it really is the individual. So you can start to see, well, okay, yeah, this is points of resonance with 2015. Yep, lots of them. Science flourishes. You know, it's based on reason. It's based on what's observable. It's based on what's repeatable. But religious issues fit into the area, into this mould, with some degree of discomfort. And our friend Descartes, many of you have had to look at Descartes in different ways, I think, therefore I am, says, well, what is humanity really? Humanity is, by this definition, at humanity's core is reason. We are thinking beings, reasoning beings, as the core human characteristic. Of course, who's familiar with Monty Python's redefinition of this statement? I could see that on your face, Paul, which is, I drink, therefore I am. Well, you know, what's that? You know, because we're so individualistic, you choose your own motto. Go with it. Okay. So what this does actually is redefines God, okay, and with something called deism. Now, it's not as we suspect that suddenly, you know, the age of reason comes storming in and suddenly everyone jettisons the idea of God and becomes atheistic. It's not the case at all. A lot of the early scientists held Christian faith, but it actually starts to get redefined by default. And gradually we could argue perhaps that this God of reason morphs into something quite different from the God that we see in Scripture. Now, some of you have probably had to look at the whole analogy of the God as the clockmaker in some of your courses, the idea that God really was creator, yes, all-powerful, yes, but very remote. So an emphasis on the whole transcendent thing and very little emphasis on a personal relationship with humanity. So God basically creates a universe, sets it in order according to certain principles, and retires to the Milky Way and sits on a cloud and has a pina colada. Okay. So, and then he's just observing what's going on. And our job as rational beings, scientists, is to discover these principles, follow God's footprints. He's put the principles in place in the universe. We follow them, we discover them, and we then learn perhaps a little bit more about this remote God who otherwise has very little to do with us. So if God's very remote, well, do we bother much about him, really? I mean, if he's not bothering terribly much about us, surely we should return the compliment. Okay? And in that case, this life really becomes the focus. Happiness, what's best for the majority, and we're responsible for our own progress. God's basically sort of abandoned us to find our own way in the universe. He's remote. So let's just get on with that and focus on our own forward momentum. So, our murder suspect, or at least our grievous bodily harm suspect, modernity, embraces religious diversity, moves towards tolerance, loves subverting established authority, a bit like a teenager, enthrones rationalism, and is very optimistic. This is a key attitude about human progress and scientific advancement. It has a strong belief in objective truth. It's out there. The truth is out there, and we can find it. Okay? And encourages skepticism about whatever is there at the time. Okay, so we have essentially identified our murder victim. But what caused it, GBH? And in fact, isn't a lot of this still with us? How sick is modernity? Well, picking up one of those, that underlying attitude we flagged a minute ago, this optimism about progress. Part of that was the belief that more science and more education will solve pretty much everything. Why are there wars? Oh, there's wars because people are unhappy. Why are people unhappy? Well, you know, there's inequity about food allocation. There's inequity about wealth allocation, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea was, if we can pour more science and more education at all these things, we'll solve all these problems, and therefore, essentially, wars will cease to have a reason to exist. Well, maybe, maybe not. As modernity rolls on, we encounter a few other key aspects of it, something called the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century, which brings great scientific advancement, further growth of the cities, decline of the rural populations, dislocation of the urban poor from their support base, lots of social problems there, which if any of you have ever read any Dickens, seen anything by Dickens, or you're well acquainted with all the dark side of the slavery and the child labour, etc., that accompanied all of that, and really showing the, if you like, the dark side of this progress at all costs mentality that was coming out of modernity. Alongside of that, we've also got the massive complexity coming as colonisation continues. Many different cultures are encountered, and modernity has to calibrate those in as well. One of my other favourite things, Romanticism, comes onto the scene and actually says, well, hang on, we don't think you rationalists have got it all together, to be perfectly honest. We do appreciate the scientific advancement. Life is more comfortable because of you. However, we think you're a bit reductionistic. We think you only see part, you're looking down a tunnel, okay? You don't like things like feelings. Nearly burst into an old song there. That would have been the end of the talk. You know, subjectivity, spontaneity. Romantics like those things, whereas, you know, the hardcore rationalists tended to have little time for those things. And hardcore rationalists had no affection at all for mystery. Mysteries were annoying. Stimulating, but annoying, because we had to go out there and solve them all. Okay? But we were confident we could. Okay, we just needed a little bit more time, a little bit more government funding, perhaps. And we'll get there. The mysteries will fall. Okay. No, well, romantics could live with mysteries. That was fine. Affected all aspects of culture and society. And these guys said, hey, hang on. Yeah, look, we value individual perception. We embrace diversity. But one other thing we don't like about you rationalistic guys is, we think you've missed the point with objectivity. We think you're kidding yourselves. And so this idea that the objectivity was something of a myth of the Enlightenment and rationalism, these guys said, right, think about this. Every time you observe something, you're not just observing, you're also participating, you're also interpreting. So you rationalists might hate the term subjectivity, but guess what? You can't escape it. Okay. And we're romantics, we don't care about escaping that, we actually like it. Okay, so... Did I? What have I done there? Okay. There we are. Right. That's better. All right. So we hit the 19th century, get three world-changing massive ideas coming out with Marx, Darwin and Freud. All of these are saying... putting forward radical new ways. Obviously not going to try and tease them all out now, but you've all had, I'm sure, some... No. Well, in Das Kapital, you know, okay. And have you ever seen a photo of Freud where he's smiling? But no, we're not going there. So these are radical ways of understanding humanity and the world around us, and all challenge the existing paradigms in different ways. So this is all exciting for the rationalists, you know, huge intellectual giants striding onto the scene, new theories to be debated, endless articles in journals and publishing credits. It's good stuff. But where does it take us? Okay, so this is really where we start looking perhaps at some of these, the challenges to modernity and some of the areas in which we say, well, it has... perhaps at least been seriously wounded, if not more. All right. So as we get into the 20th century, we notice that before that century is half over, we've had all this, okay, plus a lot more. We've had the two world wars. We've had the Great Depression. Of course, the First World War, as you know, was the one that was supposed to end them all, but somehow missed that one. We've had a Holocaust. We've had nuclear devastation. And that's all in the space of a few decades. Now, you can say at that point that really modernity has been around for 300 years, pretty much, and it hasn't solved the world's problems, okay? And what a lot of people came to the conclusion was, okay, we've been in a sense, for a lot of people, science and education had become, and progress had become the new gods. That's what people had been worshipping in the West over the last 300 years. And people started to realise there's nothing wrong with science, there's nothing wrong with education, there's nothing wrong with reason, okay? But they might make great servants, but lousy gods. Right. So what modernity has, in fact, delivered to a lot of people's minds as they're looking at the first half of the 20th century onwards, sorry, backwards, really we've just got to the point where we've become more effective at killing each other and dehumanising each other. And is this modernity thing really all it is cracked up to be? Probably not. Okay, then we hit the 1960s. So this could quite possibly be the fastest run through the last 300 years of church history I've ever done. But it's clearly not just church history, and this is the fascinating thing. This is, you know, the church has played a big role in this in numerous ways, and we haven't brought them all out. And now we've got this mutuality where we'll, as we move towards the last part of what I'm saying, thinking about, in fact, how we respond to what's going on around us. 1960s. Okay, all those servicemen who fought World War II and seen the devastation, they come home from the Second World War, servicemen, servicewomen, mid-1940s, they all get married fairly quickly and have kids. Those kids become adults in the 1960s. And that changes the world, basically. Again. All right? Why? Well, you know, you're all experts in the 1960s, because I'm looking around and I can tell at least some of you have lived through them, right? So you don't need me to do a full sociological spectrum on the 1960s. You know, it was an era of change. But what happened is those kids who became adults in the 1960s, they had grown up in homes where their parents were dealing with the disillusionment that we've just been talking about at the end of the Second World War. So it's a fairly standard point of view that I think it was, fairly standard point of view that since World War II, there was a wholesale questioning of the values of modernity. And those kids who grew up in those homes and became adults in the 1960s essentially were rejecting a lot of the ideology and a lot of the worldview that their parents had espoused and then and fought for and then come home and got disillusioned about. So, don't know if any one of you remember this bumper sticker. Subvert the dominant paradigm. Okay? Well, you know, it's a pretty good slogan, really, for the 1960s. Whatever's there, we'll subvert and we'll move somewhere different. Interestingly, this was also the era for a lot of people who were buying into modernity and the paradigms that came with that. They felt religion was dying. But funnily enough, the 1960s then discovers it's the birth of a wider concept of spirituality, the whole New Age stuff and all sorts of other belief systems start springing up in that time. Just ironically, when people thought spirituality and religious belief of all types was about to die a natural death because science and education were taking their place. So this new generation really decides that modernity largely has had its day. So welcome to the hybrid. So today, really, in the West, there's a hybrid. I'm just putting up about four categories here, and because we're highly individualised, there's probably nearly as many categories as there are people, okay? But we blend these four at least. Now, we still actually hark back to our pre-moderns, okay? Even though we're in this at the end of modernity, perhaps entering a post-modern age, there are still amongst us people who probably are more at home in the Middle Ages in terms of a worldview, okay? Who still essentially want everyone to conform to their version of reality, no matter what, and don't just get annoyed when people don't, but actually will take physical action to make people conform. And there's various varieties of those around. So it's interesting when we talk about, oh, you know, the end of the Middle Ages, the challenges at perhaps at the end of modernity, etc. There's still a blending. You know, it fascinates me that there are people who are alive today who are much more comfortable in the Middle Ages, really. The sooner we can invent time machines and perhaps let people go back to where they're comfortable, you know. Okay, choose your own time zone. Okay, then we've got, obviously, there's lots of people who still fit this. And I think probably most of us are hybrids in one way, shape or form. So, okay, there's lots of people who are still optimistic that science and education may solve all the world's problems, who say still see objectivity as an achievable thing, and therefore subjectivity is something to be rejected. They believe reality is definitely out there, and that they will eventually be able to solve all mysteries. Just give us the time and give us the grants. Okay. Continuing. Welcome to the hybrid. There's also romantics. Hey, we like rationalism. It's okay, but it's not the whole story. Please get the whole story. We don't believe objectivity is all of it. It can't be objective. Truth is out there, but subjectivity is a way towards it. We're happy with mystery. And we don't want certainty. We don't even, not necessarily sure that certainty, complete certainty, will exist anyway. Then we start moving towards a postmodern position that says, oh, come on, objectivity, give me a break, you know. Everything is subjective. And truth, well, you know, truth is just a social construct. Okay. Reality is what you make it. And there is only interpretation. No real truth. Okay. So all of us encounter all these things all the time, yeah? In ourselves, probably. You might not see all of four of those things in yourself. Probably wouldn't see all four. But you probably see at least two. And maybe sometimes three. I don't know. But this is our world. This is modernity has led us to this point. Modernity may be ailing seriously at this point, but this is where we're at, and this is where the people outside the walls of this building are at. My core argument is that essentially this isn't just a quick run through some key points of the history of Western thought, but if we don't do this, we don't really understand ourselves. That's one of the key points. One of my arguments for history is if you don't know how you got to this point, it's really hard to understand who you are now. And if you don't know who you are now, it's really hard to plan for the future. Okay? Any body of people like this, any church, is working with your identity, who you are now, and trying to plan for the future. So that's my argument as to why it's essential to see how did we actually get here and who are we and what are the complexities that we're dealing with, so that, in fact, if we don't understand the types of people that we're encountering as we move through our societies and our jobs and our schools, then it's going to be pretty difficult to reach them, to understand their paradigms. And therefore, obviously, it's essential to work with their assumptions of reality. Okay. That's it for me for the moment. I'm not sure how are we going for time? Any time? Okay. Did anyone want to throw anything at me, or do we not have? Okay. Okay. Anything? Paul?
So, taking the kind of different categories you've pasted, looking at the rejection, people who haven't dealt with the climate issue, and you've had people who were basically rejected the whole scientific process and
I guess it depends on how they're tackling it, because I know I've seen arguments saying, well, I've seen arguments countering the science with at least attempted science. Okay, so arguments saying, well, actually the Arctic ice cap is growing or something like that, you know? So it really would depend on how they're responding, not necessarily just the point of view. So a lot of this is about assumptions and attitudes. So I guess that would be my response to that one. Okay, I think the growth of the technologies effectively has given everybody a voice and allowed people to construct in many ways. Therefore, I think it has fed very much into the post-modernity model, which... well, looking at if everyone's got a voice and all voices... You know, one of the things that we come down to, I guess, is yes, there's the diversity and there's the plurality, but then there's the question of are all voices equally valid? Okay, and what there are interesting books being written, and I certainly haven't read all of them, about the intolerance of tolerance is the title of one particular book. The idea being that, you know, this is a sort of a bit of a funny pun I've heard from someone else, the idea, you know, this moving away from absolutes, moving towards everything being relative and individualized. And so you get to the funny position where that the only absolute that people who deny absolutes will hold to is that there are no absolutes. So you get to that ironic point of view, which it can, you know, obviously is a, you can maybe pick a couple of holes in that particular argument. But I think that, you know, the technologies have fueled that plethora of voices and also therefore perhaps fueled the implicit understanding that wherever there's a voice, it's equally valid. Okay. And that is a an assumption, I think, that is there in post-modernity. And I think it's an assumption that should be challenged. Yeah. Just because a voice exists doesn't give it... Does it have a right to exist? Yeah. But does that mean, you know, any teacher or lecturer marking any papers, I mean, you know, are they all equally sound? Well, no. You know, and so that applies, it's not intolerant to critique someone's argument. It's intolerant to say they don't have a right to make the argument. Whoa! Okay, taking it offline.